Chapter 6. The World Falls Dead. Eventually, the exodus of the Adamic race became known to the Serpent Masters, who grew furious and vengeful. This was the third time that their plans and exploits had been thwarted. First, they were banished from their home planet. Then, after coming to a new one, they created a race to serve them, but which did not, and when they finally created the perfect serpent, they found them permanently seduced away from their duties. The ire of the Atlanteans at this snubbing was so intense that they unleashed an atomic war on the sons of the serpent and their Adamic wards, now resident on Lemuria, Oceania. These latter were not unprepared, however, and being technically advanced, set up to defend themselves and retaliate against their evil adversaries on Atlantis. So, there was on Earth a nuclear war. It was an event that changed the face of Earth history. The war between the gods, the Serpent Masters and the Sons of the Serpents, and subsequent paroxysms were recorded by almost all the cultures of the world, and God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man, and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them, Genesis 6-8, and there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought in his angels, and prevailed not, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent, called the devil, and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him, Revelation 12:7-12. Woe unto us! Who shall deliver us out of the land of these almighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all manner of plagues in the wilderness, 1 Samuel 4:8, and all the cities thereof were broken down at the presence of the Lord and by his fierce anger, Jeremiah 4:26. For behold, the Lord will come with fire, and his chariots, like the whirlwind, to render his anger with fury, Isaiah 66:15, and the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every freeman, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and they shall go into the holes of the rocks, and into the caves of the earth, for fear of the Lord, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth, Isaiah 6:15. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which heaven shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, the earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up, 2 Peter 3:10. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness, and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead, and only I am escaped alone to tell thee, Job 1:19. His lightnings enlightened the world, the earth saw and trembled, the hills melted like wax at the presence of the Lord, Psalms 97:4. While reading these accounts, one may do well to reflect on the personality of the Lord and wonder if the activities mentioned are not those to be expected of a more human agency. I am the Lord and there is none else. I form the light and create the darkness, I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things, Book of Isaiah. He that sacrificeth to any god save unto the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed, Exodus 22:20. By the sweat of your face will be your bread, until you return to the ground, for out of it you are taken, for dust you are and to dust you will return, Genesis 3:19. Then shall ye know that I am the Lord, when their slain men shall be among their idols round about their altars, upon every high hill, in all the tops of the mountains, and under every green tree, and under every thick oak, the place where they did offer sweet savour to all their idols, so will I stretch out my hand upon them, and make the land desolate, and they shall know that I am the Lord, Ezekiel 6:13-14. Wherefore, as I live, saith the Lord God, surely, because thou hast defiled my sanctuary with all thy detestable things, and with all thine abominations, therefore will I also diminish thee, neither shall mine eye spare, neither will I have any pity, Ezekiel 5:11. So will I send upon you famine and evil beasts, and they shall bereave thee, and pestilence and blood shall pass through thee, and I will bring the sword upon thee, I the Lord have spoken it, Ezekiel 5:17. It appears, after all, that the words of Madame Helena Blavatsky, who spent her life researching the actual origins of mankind, are more than appropriate. The appellation Satan, in Hebrew, and adversary, belongs by right to the first and cruelest adversary of all other gods, Jehovah, not in the serpent which spoke only words of sympathy and wisdom. Under the evil insinuations of their demon Thevenet, the Atlantis race became a nation of evil magicians. The giants and magicians and all flesh died in every man, and author Jack Barringer also expresses the travesty of man's perplexity. We have been led to believe that the entity that the Old Testament describes as a mass murderer and heinous leader is the God of the universe. We have been led to think that the slaughter of human beings in the name of God is a divine act, and all through these passages is the reference to more than one God. A perfect example follows: thou shalt not revile the gods, Exodus 22:28. Scholar and genius Ignatius Donnelly wrote of the tribulations, it sounds like the cry not of a man but of a race, a great, religious, civilized race, who could not understand how God could so cruelly visit the world. And from Commons Beaumont's The Riddle of Prehistoric Britain, the prehistory of the Atlanteans and the race of Adam possess peculiar similarities. The supermen of Plato's island were drowned in a flood like the Adamites, the giants of old time, men of renown, the men whose thoughts became wholly evil, destroyed in what is called the flood or universal deluge. The cause advanced for their destruction was in effect the same in both cases, they being accused of having mastered too many of the divine secrets of, as we should say, science, as the ancients named it, the gods. The Indians of Lake Tahoe, California say, there was a time when their tribe possessed the whole earth and were strong and numerous and rich, but a day came when a people rose up stronger than they and defeated and enslaved them. Afterward, the Great Spirit sent an immense wave across the continent from the sea, and this wave engulfed both the oppressors and the oppressed, all but a very small remnant, the ancient Britons. The profligacy of mankind had provided the Great Supreme to send a pestilential wind upon the earth. A pure poison descended, every blast was death. Presently, a tempest fire arose. It split the earth asunder to the great deep. Rain poured down from heaven, and water covered the earth. From Destruction of Atlantis by Ignatius Donnelly, Bolivian records going back 5,000 years tell of the destruction of civilization in far-off times as the result of a conflict with some non-human race whose blood was not red like ours. The Yurucar Indians of Bolivia speak of the demon Amasun, who destroyed plants, animals, and man by causing fire to fall from heaven. The Algonquin Indians relate, long ago, two powerful manitous felt themselves insulted by the hero Wissaka. This put them into a fearful passion, and intending to kill their enemy, they raged and roared over the earth, which heaved and shook under their angry steps. From the Norse Edda, we read, then saw she wade in heavy streams, men foul murderers and perjurers, and them who others' wives seduced to sin, brothers slay brothers, sisters' children shed each other's blood. Hard is the world, sensual sin grows huge. These are the sword ages, axe ages, shields are cleft in twain, storm ages, murder ages, till the world falls dead. The Norse legends tell of the great winters of wind, sword, and wolf which descended upon the earth. The second winter is called the winter of the sword. Those of mankind left alive rob and slay one another for what is left to feed on. Brother slays brother, mighty battles occur in the world. Their adversarial presence was termed the Midgard serpent. The Midgard serpent blows so much poison that the whole sky and sea are splattered with it. Strange flying craft bringing destruction are described. The mighty flood frees the ship known as Naglfar, a vessel that the giants were so long in building. Loki steers the ship of hell with the Fenris wolf aboard. They also speak specifically of Ragnarok, the war between the gods, the head of Mimir, fountain of all wisdom, counsels Odin to meet on the field of Vigrid, and to wage there such a war that the power of evil would be destroyed forever, even though his own world would be destroyed with them. Now death is the portion of doomed men. Red with blood the buildings of gods, the sun turns black in the summer after, wines wine. In northern Sweden, the Laplanders preserve their accounts. Their ancient books say, I shall reverse the world, I shall bid the rivers flow upward, I shall cause the sea to gather together itself up into a huge towering wall which I shall hurl upon your wicked earth children, and thus destroy them in all life. The Scandinavian Skalds record in their sagas and poems, Surtr, Saturn, from the south winds, with seething fire, the falchion of the Mighty One, a sunlight flaming, mountains dash together, giants headlong rush, men rend the paths of hell, and heaven is rent in twain. Siberian accounts relate, in the beginning was the earth, but then a great fire arose and raged for 7 years and the earth was burned up, everything became sea. All the Tuungus were consumed except a boy and a girl who rose up with an eagle in the sky. The Persians Bundrahis relate in their legends, and 90 days and nights the heavenly angels were contending in the world with the confederate demons of the evil spirit, and there are the commentaries of more modern sources also, from those illustrious ones who have contributed to our present civilization. Here are just a few examples. From Ovid's Metamorphosis, giants attacked the very throne of heaven, Jove struck them down. Three times had Poseidon, Neptune, ventured with stern countenance to thrust his arms out of the water. Three times he was unable to endure the scorching heat of the air. From Plato's Timaeus, in one day and one fatal night, there came mighty earthquakes and inundations that engulfed that warlike peoples. The people, terrified, could hardly breathe, mouths were drenched in blood, heads wallowed in blood, the face was made pale by the evil wind. From Plato's Critias, this vast power, gathered into one, endeavored to subdue with a blow our country and yours and the whole of the region. Then, Solon, your country shone forth, in the excellence of her virtue and strength among all mankind. She was preeminent in military skill and was the leader of the Hellenes. She defeated and triumphed over the invaders and preserved from slavery those who were not yet subjugated, and generously liberated all the rest of us who dwelled between the pillars. But afterwards, occurred violent earthquakes and floods, and in a single day and night of misfortune all your warlike men in a body sank into the earth, and the island of Atlantis in like manner disappeared in the depths of the sea. From the Homeric sagas, we read, beneath the feet of the father of the gods Olympus shook as he moved, the earth groaned, and from the lightning of his bolt, as well as from the eyes and breath of his antagonist, fire was bursting over the dark sea, the ocean boiled, towering waves beat upon all promontories of the coast, the ground quaked, Hades, lord of the dead, trembled, and even Zeus himself, for a time, was unstrung. And let us not neglect the accounts from Egypt, later bastion of the sons of the serpents. From the Egyptian Ipuwer papyrus of 1780 BC, we read, the land to its whole extent confusion and terrible noise. For 9 days there was no exit from the palace and no one could see the face of his fellow. Towns were destroyed by mighty tides, Upper Egypt suffered devastation, blood everywhere, pestilence throughout the country. The Egyptian scribe Manetho records information seemingly about the era of the pharaoh Amenophis, but which is really about a previous time. His was an intensely dramatic era which culminated in a prolonged war, the invasion of his country by vast and well-armed hordes, accompanied by meteorological events of a phenomenal character, and finally ended in the great catastrophe which destroyed him and most of his nation. In spell 316 of the Egyptian coffin texts, we find the following passages, referring to powerful destructive weaponry. So the gods were brought together, readdress none, behold, mankind who came from my eye, have been scheming against me. None replied, Ori, if your eye was turned against those, how greatly would they fear you? Hathor said, I have prevailed over mankind and it is pleasant to my heart. Then Re said, now that I am in control of them, do not reduce them any more. Behold it, the I will be stronger than all the gods. It has mastered those who dwellest at the ends of the earth. It is sovereign over every god. They will fall howling on their faces. All mankind will cringe beneath you and your might. They will respect you when they behold you in vigorous form which the master of the primeval gods gave you. This same eye turns up in Irish mythology as Balor's evil eye, which needed to be operated, that is, opened and closed by Balor's 9 specially trained bodyguards. The descriptions clearly relate to some kind of lethal device. The Celtic legends are very lucid in respect to magical weaponry and powers. We read of weapons of strange power and magical properties, which literally needed several men to use. Their records give pronounced indications of genetic engineering in the tales of demonic hybrid entities, called the Fomorian race, or men of Lochlin, endowed with great powers, clairvoyance, and physical strength. We hear mention of glass towers from which the evil overlords could keep watch over the entire island. The later races subjugated the land of Ireland and its natives for centuries until they were finally overthrown. The Celtic word Fomhuire means giants, and also derives from a term that means from under the seas. The myths say that the Fomorians lived under the ocean. Interestingly, one of the ancient names for the mythical lost isles was Tir Fothún, meaning land beneath the wave. One of these mysterious weapons mentioned in the Irish sagas was the Lance of Lu, the sun god. Lu was called Ildanach, or master of all the arts, but also the far shooter. Here is a description of his strange lance. He also had a magic spear, which he had no need to wield himself, for it was alive and thirsted for blood. When battle was near, it was drawn out. Then it roared and struggled against its thongs. Fire flashed from it. It tore through and through the ranks of the enemy, never tired of slaying. See Celtic Myth and Legend by Charles Squire, The Book of Conquests, and The Silver Arm by Jim Fitzpatrick. Another weapon of power was the sword of the High King Nuada, called Retaliator. It is the prototype of Excalibur. Retaliator was said to vibrate in the presence of negative forces or enemies. The Celts had the strange prohibition that no king could rule who was blemished. This does not make sense until we realize what it relates to is genetic alteration. The High King of the Gaels, Nuada himself, had to step down as leader after his arm was severed in the Titanic War with the Fomorian hybrids. He subsequently had his missing limb replaced with a silver arm. The astonishing account of this limb's magical replacement clearly bespoke some form of advanced cybernetics. See Celtic Myth and Legend by Charles Squire. The Greeks and Teutons, as so many others, also have records of hybrid beings that had the countenance of either great beauty or ugliness. See Clash of the Titans, Jason and the Argonauts, The Odyssey, and The Amazing Voyages of Sinbad. The Hindu Srimad Bhagavatam tells of a demon race which invaded the three planetary systems. Opposing the demons was the god Shiva, who, it is recorded, possessed a powerful weapon that he fired at the enemy airships from his own. In the ancient Ramayana, there is mention of an iron thunderbolt capable of killing hundreds of thousands of humans. It was also said to be so powerful that it could have destroyed the earth. These weapons could only be used by royal decree. There are even passages where it mentions the fact that the weapon was used as retaliation for the other side using it first. In another Vedic tome called Samarangana Satradhara, there is mention of manned space rockets, as well as their means of propulsion. In the Samarasadradhara, we find mention of the use of biological weapons, each of which produced its own specific effect. The Samhara debilitated its victims by attacking the motor center of the brain, and the Moha caused blockage of nerve impulses, resulting in complete paralysis. In the Chinese Feng Shen Venii, we find similar descriptions of germ warfare, and again references made to specific weapons causing specific results. The Indian philosopher Alukaya discussed in his teachings the miniature solar system within the atom, molecular construction and transformation, as well as the theory of relativity, more than 2,800 years before Einstein. From the epic Mahabharata, we read the following astonishing passage. It was as if the elements had been unleashed. The sun spun round, scorched by the incandescent heat of the weapon. The world reeled in fever. Elephants were set on fire by the heat and ran to and fro in a frenzy. Water boiled, animals died, the enemy was mown down, and the raging of the blaze made the trees collapse. Horses and war chariots were burnt up. Thousands of chariots were destroyed. Then deep silence descended on the sea. The corpses of the fallen were mutilated by the terrible heat so that they no longer looked like human beings. Never before have we seen such a ghastly weapon, and never before have we heard of such a weapon. When the Mahabharata was to be translated in the last half of the 19th century into modern languages, the descriptions of ancient warfare were generally expunged. His sabha clung to the sky at a league's length. He threw at me rockets, missiles, spears, spikes, battle axes, three-bladed javelins, flamethrowers. Without pausing, the sky seemed to hold 100 suns, 100 moons, and 100 myriad stars. Neither day nor night could be made out, or the points of compass. And again, this weapon was so feared that in great distress of mind the king had the bolt reduced to fine powder and thrown into the sea. Even with these precautions, people's hair and fingernails fell out overnight, birds turned white and their legs became scarlet and blistered, and food went bad. Gorka flying in his swift and powerful Vimana hurled against the three cities of the Vricious and Anhikas a single projectile charged with all the power of the universe. It was the unknown weapon, the Iron Thunderbolt, a gigantic messenger of death which reduced to ashes the entire race of the Vricious and Anhikas. The corpses were so burned as to be unrecognizable. Their hair and nails fell out, pottery broke without apparent cause, and the birds turned white. After a few hours all foodstuffs were infected. To escape from this fire the soldiers threw themselves in streams to wash themselves and their equipment. Pratap Chandra Roy's translation of 1889. In the 1950s the father of the atomic bomb, Robert Oppenheimer, who frequently quoted the Mahabharata, was asked by a student at Rochester University whether his atomic bomb was the first in history to be exploded. He suggestively answered, "Well, yes, in modern times, of course." Add to these accounts those of visitations and even space journeys, like those of Ezekiel, Enoch and Etana, and others. Moreover, how does the detractor explain the presence of radioactive tektites and isotopes at the very sites now known to be the biblical Sodom and Gomorrah and Jericho? What of the strange radioactive corpses found in Mohenjo-Daro in India, the descriptions of which accord perfectly with what was seen in Nagasaki and Hiroshima? What are we to make of the presence of fused glass in Scotland, Iraq, and Libya? Tektites found at these and other locations continue to confound the experts. In the Libyan desert, fused glass, radioactive tektites, were discovered and then analyzed by D.R.R.V. Dolphin. After studying the Libyan desert glass, Dolphin suggested that for the ancient Phoenicians to have worked with temperatures equivalent to 6,000 degrees Celsius, they may have known the secret of atomic power, see page 115. The Atlantis Blueprint by Colin Wilson and Rand Flemath. 6,000 degrees Celsius is only 2,000 degrees less than the temperature of the sun. In the same place was found jars and vases which had been fashioned in the same manner as one would see clay. The only difference was that these artifacts were made of some of the hardest substances known, basalt, quartz, and diorite. The necks of the vases were so narrow that no hand could have been used to fashion their interiors. High temperatures had to have been employed, but how is still a mystery to the experts. Exceptionally high temperatures are also needed to remove impurities from gold. Scientists were perplexed when necklaces found in the Libyan desert were made of 100% pure gold. The answer to all this is what was suspected by the good doctor, but which most academics are very reluctant to accept. Atomic energy was indeed known and used in the days of old. Researchers and authors, Valdemar Valerian, Charles Berlitz, J.J. Herdeck, and David Hatcher Childress, relate hundreds of accounts such as this in their pivotal works. In the account of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the fleeing prophet, Lot, is told by the angels of the Lord not to turn back, because the wrath of the Lord was coming to that place. Lot's wife does look back and is straightaway turned into what is described as a pillar of salt, but this is a mistranslation. The word is more like our English vapor. Add to these the accounts of the walls of Jericho, or the story in Exodus of the 10 plagues, not to mention the entire books of Job, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Revelation, which are full of catastrophe and godly wrath. With all this and an endless amount more, it becomes practically and rationally irrefutable that a war of the gods did indeed take place in pre-diluvian times, when ferocious weaponry was possessed and used by both sides. There is good reason to believe that the terms Sodom and Gomorrah originally referred to Atlantis, Appalachia, and Lemuria. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven, and he overthrew those cities, and all the plains, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and that which grew upon the ground, Genesis 19:25. And again, mention of weapons, O my people that dwellest in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian, he shall smite thee with a rod, and shall lift up his staff against thee, after the manner of Egypt, Isaiah 10:24. He shall flee from the iron weapon, and the bow shall strike him through, Job 20:24. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, and the staff in their hand is mine indignation, woe unto us. Who shall deliver us out of the land of these almighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all manner of plagues in the wilderness, 1 Samuel 4, 8. That the ancients had weapons of power has been a fact long sequestered by the elites. Authors who have sought to expose the facts have been persecuted, ridiculed, and had their works suppressed. One of these master researchers was Commons Beaumont, who wrote the following: "I have said comparatively little in regard to the prehistoric science in weapons, including firearms, although it is manifest that they played the most vital part in ancient power politics. Possession of the knowledge of metallurgy must have been one of the most urgent yet secret objects on the part of those who desire to rule the ancient world. I cannot overstress how vital and important is always the problem of weapons." In his book Interpretation of Radium, the great physicist Frederick Soddy wrote, "Can we not read in them some justification for the belief that some forgotten race of men attain not only the knowledge that we have so recently won, but also that power that is not yet ours? I believe that there have been civilizations in the past that were familiar with atomic energy and that by misusing it they were totally destroyed." The Smithsonian Institute and the Bureau of Standards in Washington finally proved that over 7,000 years ago, steel was made in furnaces which burned as hot as 9,000 degrees centigrade. But those who have read the Book of Enoch will recall that the contrivance of metal and weapons had different origins than any modern scientist is going to publicly espouse. And as Azel taught men to make swords, and knives and shields and breastplates and made known to them the metals of the earth and the art of working with them, and they were led astray, and became corrupt in all their ways, the war of the gods is recorded in the Bible. Veiled references to it include the term firstborn. This euphemism turns up in the Old Testament. We read of Jehovah, for instance, striking down the firstborn of the Pharaoh for Moses. Later, in the New Testament, Herod goes after the firstborn of the so-called Israelites in his search for the Christ child. Few ask what is productive in attacking those without any sin, when the resources would be better used striking at the actual enemy. Little in theological texts will make sense until that which is literal is distinguished from what is not, when primary usages of a word, phrase, or term are distinguished from secondary or tertiary usages. Firstborn relates to the original progeny of the serpent masters, that is, the members of the Lemurian race. Things become easier still when we identify the serpent masters with the race of Jehovah and the sons with the Elohim. Elohim comes from Elu, meaning the shining ones. Shining ones is an ambivalent term used for both the Nephilim and their firstborn. The shining ones are often depicted with horns on their heads. This was a symbol of wisdom, but also of rulership. This is why shamans, priests, and kings adopted the convention of wearing horns also, especially in the form of the crown. This was to primarily indicate that they were descendants of either the Atlanteans or the Lemurians and were endowed with power. Michelangelo sculpted Moses with horns on his head to indicate his blood bond to the antediluvian kings. Every scholar must be aware that there are two distinct styles, two schools, so to speak, plainly traceable in the Hebrew scriptures, the Elohistic and the Jehovistic. The portions belonging to these respectively are so blended together, so completely mixed up by later hands, that often all external characteristics are lost. Yet it is known that the two schools were antagonistic. Madame Helena Blavatsky, The Secret Doctrine, Volume 3. Many cryptic terms are used to describe the adversaries and their conflict. Many seemingly incomprehensible motifs and anecdotes from the world's legends can be made lucid once the reader knows what is really being implied. And this was comprehended by the American master of the pre-Diluvian epics, Ignatius Donnelly, who demonstrated his discernment concerning the terrestrial tribulations, when he wrote, "It sounds like the cry not of a man but of a race, a great, religious, civilized race, who could not understand how God could so cruelly visit the world." This fact can be corroborated by a close reading of the Old Testament. In it, we hear of the strange meeting Moses had at the burning bush. This has long been a point of conjecture, but can easily be explained when the imagery is replaced by fact. Jehovah announces to the question of Moses, "I am the God of thy fathers." Scholars have pointed out that the doubt of Moses as to the nature and preeminence of Jehovah is strange, to say the least, and that Jehovah should need no introduction to a devoted Israelite. Moreover, the introduction clearly implies that Moses is in fact one of the progeny of the sons of the serpents, his fathers, but has now had the misfortune to come into contact with one of their fathers, that is, one of the original serpent masters, maybe even the main man. The second revealing anecdote happens when Moses and Aaron are in the presence of the Pharaoh. The scriptures speak of them having to prove their credentials to Pharaoh by changing Aaron's rod into a serpent. This is strange, since Israelites were forbidden by Jehovah to engage in magical practices. Anyway, the Egyptians produce their own rod, which likewise becomes a serpent, and so on. This tale of the conflict between the two serpents is a barely disguised reference to that between the races. The same motif appears in the Arthurian sagas, with a contest between the red and white dragons, which is the dream of Uther Pendragon, father of King Arthur. The very name Pendragon means head of the dragons, that is, the race of good serpents, from which the Celts and Gaels descended. Other cultures have similar leitmotifs expressing the same story. The Saxon tale of Saint George and the Dragon is a perfect fictional rendition of it. In the Old Testament, passages relating to the twins, Jacob and Esau, may well refer obliquely to the pre-Diluvian bipartisanism and their ongoing antagonism. In your limbs lie nations twain, rival races from their birth, one the mastery shall gain, the younger or the elder reign. The meaning behind the euphemisms of the combating serpents or dragons has to do with the antagonism within the biology of the Homo Atlantis. The references to the coils of DNA, to the alien and human strands and their incompatibility, the folktales which have to do with the evil and good twin, the dark and fair sisters, the white and black witches, the twin towers, the true and false knights, the hero's descent and ascent, etc., also conceal the same meta-theme. From Robin Hood to Swan Lake, from Hercules and the Hydra to Jason and the Golden Fleece, from the Odin hanging on the winding tree to Conan the Barbarian, from Alice through the Looking Glass to Dungeons and Dragons, the themes are one. What is the Tree of the East and the Tree of the West? What are the two seraphim who guard the Ark of the Covenant? What are the gates of Valhalla? Why are there twin columns at the portals of illustrious edifices? What do the swastika, the double-headed eagle, the Masonic double cube, the double-bird cross of Lorraine, the two Knights Templars riding one horse, really signify? What are the real pillars of Hercules that guarded the way to Atlantis?